spiritual than a political event.
Time for Stay Human, stories and poetry, music and musings. On today's show, we're crossing over to the other side. That's Timbuk 3. I'm Michael Goldberg, and on today's program, we'll hear from Terry O'Brien on the occasion of her 70th birthday. We also have a story from Matthew Miltich, a story he wrote for his young grandson's question, "What happens to us when we die?" I've been watching several of the new television shows that take on that question. It's interesting that the afterlife has gotten to be such a popular and even a playful genre lately on TV. According to Gallup polls, 81% of Americans believe in heaven and 70% believe in hell. I don't know what people mean when they answer yes to that question. I can't imagine they all mean the same thing. It's a little hard for me to understand this poll result. I mean, for me personally, the idea that I would have my ego, my sense of myself as an individual for always, that idea has always seemed slightly horrifying to me, certainly a mortifying one. And I'm not sure which, if any, of the people I know are part of that 80%. I want to tell you about some of these new TV shows later in this hour, but thinking about it led me to return to a little diamond of a book that offers 40 tales from the afterlives. It's by David Eagleman, and its title is Sum, S-U-M, as if it might all add up somehow. Here's one of those 40 tales. Apostasy. In the afterlife, you meet God. To your surprise and delight, she is like no God that humans have conceived. She shares qualities with all religions' descriptions, but commands a deific grandeur that was captured in the net of none. She is the elephant described by blind men, all partial descriptions with no understanding of the whole. You can see in her glittering eyes how delighted she is to hand forth the Book of Truth. The book cleanly addresses your lifetime of questions with no philosophical gaps or loose threads. As you observe her excitement about revealing this, you begin to suspect that, deep down, she was afraid that an especially clear-thinking theologian would guess the answer. All the clues were there, and only people's personal backgrounds got in the way. You notice that she feels relief as she watches, while people's biases and traditions impede clear theological guessing. It is only because of these cultural blinders that she retains her enviable position of revealing the universe's great secrets each day as the dead cross over to her territory in the next dimension. If these people were able to completely shake their traditions, the claims of their ancestors, the songs of their childhood, she reasons, they would have a decently clear shot at the right answer. And this is why she was always leery of apostates, those who rejected the particulars of their religion in search of something that seemed more truthful. She disliked them because they seemed the most likely to float a correct guess. If you assumed that God is fond of those who hold loyally to their religions, you were right, but probably for the wrong reasons. She likes them only because they are intellectually non-adventurous and will be sure to get the answer just a bit wrong. Upon their arrival in the afterlife, she divides people into the apostates on her left and the loyalists on her right. The apostates are put on the down escalator, and only the loyals remain in heaven. Each day, she welcomes new loyals from 2,000 religions. She watches them study the Book of Truth and waits for it to sink in with a delicious thrill. But something has gone terribly wrong with her plan. The truth does not convince. The newly arrived loyals have an imperturbable capacity to hold the beliefs with which they arrived, a deep reluctance to consider evidence that separates them from their lifelong context. So she finds herself unappreciated and lonely, wandering in solitude among the infinite cloudscapes of the non-believing believers. From David Eagleman's Sum, 40 Tales of the Afterlives. Of course, all stories about dying are told by those left behind. Here's a story from Mike Elliott, a frequent contributor to our program, called Grandpa's Last Ride.
A Catholic priest on St. Paul's North End once said, "A man born blind from birth will never know the meaning of darkness because he has never experienced light." No one knew what to do with my grandfather, Cliff Coatney, after he died. Blind since birth, Grandpa Cliff did not much believe in going to Mass. He claimed he was spiritual, but not religious. "Too much of religion is about raising money, not about worshiping God," he told me one day. Once he hit a Bible banger with his cane when the man told him, "You know, God don't give you nothing you can't handle." Grandfather's frustration was not about his lack of sight, but rather with the way some reacted to it, all awkward, full of pity. He married his blind sweetheart, my grandma, the day after they both turned 16. "She was a sight for sore eyes," Grandpa joked, "but she sure did smell good." My grandfather loved teaching high school civics and politics. The first Tuesday of every summer month, he walked to his bank, returning to make bag luncheons for our Mississippi River shore fishing trip, and he quizzed me on government. My job was to listen and fold his new bills. Ones were left unfolded, fives creased crosswise, and tens lengthwise. The U.S. should do like Ireland, make them all different sizes, so blind folks don't get screwed, he said. Even cornered Senator Humphrey after parade and lobbied him on changing the dimensions of paper money. They both parted laughing. My grandfather died, sitting in his easy chair, listening to a Prairie Home Companion, his favorite radio show. Mom followed his instructions and had him cremated. We threw a party, complete with his favorites. Plenty of Jameson whiskey, Cheetos, and Patsy Cline music. His urn sat in our family room for weeks. At Thanksgiving, all of my relatives labored over what to do with my grandfather's ashes. We could put some in our gardens, Cliff's younger sister suggested. Or maybe at the lake, under that big cedar, where he sat and listened to us grandkids jump off the dock, my older sister suggested. Actually, Grandpa told me where he wanted to go once, I said. Where would that be? Mom asked. We were playing poker, just the two of us. He let me have a beer, and he had a few. He insisted that he didn't want his ashes in a cemetery or on the mantle. Tell them just to throw me on the freeway when I'm gone, he said. Everyone was smiling. Well, it's all settled then, Mom said. After pie, we all get in the van, head west, and empty my dad's ashes between the Dale and Snelling Avenue exits. Grandpa wanted them on I-94 because it went all the way from St. Paul to Billings, and he always wanted to visit Montana.
Thanks to Mike Elliott. He's a writer living in Jacobson, Minnesota, which he reports has a population of 161 and still growing. Starting from our youngest childhood, we all spend our lives learning about death. But Northern Community Radio's morning show host Heidi Holton got an unusual opportunity as a teenager to think about the subject more objectively.
In high school, I signed up for and got to take a class called Death and Dying. It was a sociology class, and it was taught by Mrs. Lamore, who was kind of this, everybody was intrigued by her and wanted to take classes from her. She had MS, so she usually wasn't in her wheelchair, but she pushed her wheelchair around. She was just a striking woman who always wore bright red lipstick and fingernails, bright white hair. And so people just kind of wanted to be in her classes. I'm not sure what intrigued me about taking a class on death and dying, but I did. And I didn't realize that it had affected me later in life when I needed that information. It was my brother pointing it out to me that I could handle going to a funeral home and asking what the cost of all these things were. Because that's what we learned in the class, which was sort of strange. We took field trips. We went to two funeral homes in Brainerd. We went to the morgue. And the reason I was remembering her red fingernails is because she would remember her pointing. We're in the basement of the Brainerd Hospital, St. Joseph's, in the morgue, and there were like jars. There was a jar with a spinal cord in it. And I remember her pointing with that red fingernail, and she was delighted to show us kind of the science of bodies. And we were all, at first, I think all a little creeped out, and then we kind of became fascinated too. It wasn't as weird for us. Mrs. Lamore, so her husband was also a teacher in the school, and they were notorious for making us memorize things. So I'm not sure how useful it is that I know how much embalming fluid from 1986 cost, but it got in my head. I think it was under $100. It was one of the elements. But I think what she was teaching us is it's line itemed when you go to do a funeral for your loved one. She was reminding us that when you have to do this in your life, you're at the most stressed out point you've ever been. But that if you can't afford a funeral, it could mess up the rest of your life. And that you should ask. You shouldn't just take, you know, what is written there in front of you. And so the first time I had to kind of use some of those skills that I didn't realize I had was when my grandfather died. And when I went to set up the funeral with my grandmother and my dad, I think. And my grandpa was an accountant, and he worked really hard and had to save his money. And I knew that he would not want to spend a chunk of his money left on a fancy casket. And so they were showing us the caskets, and the funeral director kind of mumbled, "Well, there's some in the back." And I said, "Oh, well, could we see those?" And so they took us into like a cold garage, and they looked just as fine. It wasn't like they were just pine boxes, you know? So I'm like, oh, and we saved probably, I think in all, maybe $1,000, which I felt like that was what I was doing for Grampy, was giving my grandmother an extra $1,000 to do something fun instead of spending it on him. We read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book and read it for a long time and discussed it in class on death and dying. And so a lot of it was going through the stages of grief and also kind of talking about how those stages of grief are not always about death. You know, they're loss of things in your life too. So I didn't realize that's what had guided me then to how to figure out my father's and then my mother's funeral as well, to kind of be a little bit, not that you're not sad, but to be paying attention a little bit of a different way when you're sitting in the funeral home. When I told her that, it had helped me concretely in life and getting through really difficult parts of life, she kind of couldn't respond. She couldn't believe it. So
that's Heidi Holton. When I first heard her describe that class, it made me wonder why practical realities, including dealing with death, aren't part of every high school curriculum. You know, we teach kids driver's education, but we don't give them much of an idea about where they're going.
Wondering, wondering why I'm here. What am I here for? What am I here for? What does my living all mean? Where do I come from? Where am I going? What is this pause in between? Wonder why you wonder about tomorrow morn.
Every day is a new day.
It'll come as sure as you're born. What am I here for? What am I here for? Maybe I'm doing it now. Where do I come from? Where am I going? None of my business, no how. What's the use of wondering why? Long as you're living, that's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for. Life is only given for living.
Me, I roll along, I sing a song, and I'm so happy while I'm singing. Music is the most outstanding pleasure to me.
And after all, doing what you love while you're living in tails or in tatters, this is all that matters.
Plenty of times I wonder, life is barren, life is sorrow, no incentive, no tomorrow.
Forgetting completely tomorrow's another new day.
You can bet every day's gonna show another one away. Every day.
You can bet that as long as you live, that certainly tomorrow will be.
Tell me, what are you doing? Tell me, what are you here to do? And what does your living really mean? Really, really mean? Where'd you live before you made it on the earth? Where you're going when you leave it? And what this false called life may live in between? Anybody knows you're not supposed to wonder the reason why you're here. Whether you find out why or not, living's all you can do. What do you do but live your life? And you take what life can give. Never mind the reason. None of your business, the reason.
Lambert Hendricks and Ross with a Duke Ellington tune. More great jazz coming up in the 6 o'clock hour. Stay tuned for Jazz on America Avenue. Northwood storyteller Terry O'Brien offers us this next piece on the occasion of her 70th birthday. Sexagesimal No More.
Once, years ago, when I regularly ran the roads of my rural neighborhood, I saw a ways ahead of me what appeared to be an adult black bear shambling down the same side of the road as I was, heading in the same direction. This was not the first time I had encountered a bear while out walking. Years earlier, with my baby Nathan on my back, his small head swathed in a red bandana to give him some protection from mosquitoes, I was hiking in from the blacktop on a narrow dirt road that parallels the Mississippi to our rustic home 4 miles into the woods. At the place where the bear appeared, the bank is high and drops away abruptly to River Meadow. My eyes to the trail. I didn't see the bear until we were very close. My young son alerted me. His wide eyes forward, he lurched suddenly in his carrier at the sight of this big black beast. Fortunately for us, it wasn't a mother bear, also shepherding her young homeward after a busy day in town. The bear, equally as startled as we, lumbered off down the bank. Farther down that dirt road is an old story and a half log house with a narrow framed-in addition on the east side. The house isn't one of these modern palatial log structures, the second home of people who live in the cities, the scenic backdrop to their biannual trips up north. No, it just had one room, which served as living room and bedroom. The shed-roofed add-on housed the kitchen and a sink with a pitcher pump. The outhouse with its tattered Sears Roebuck catalog was, appropriately, out back. This was the home of Ada Dexter, Old Lady Dexter, as some called her. She was old, in 1975, in her early 80s, tall, thin, a few teeth teetered in her mouth. Since her husband died, Rover, a roomy-eyed black and tan spaniel, was her only companion. She was welcoming to the back to the Landers who lived further down the road on a large clearing in tents, a teepee, and a VW bus, allowing us to use her phone. Nevertheless, Ada Dexter was strictly no nonsense. Had I stopped to tell her about my close call with the bear, there would have been no sympathy for any lingering palpitations I might have felt. Had Rover the dog come looking for a little petting, in her creaky voice she would have commanded, "Rover, get under the bed!" That springy old double bed was the throne from which Ada reigned. Rover's overgrown nails skittered and scraped on the linoleum as he scrambled to obey. Whenever my baby boy fussed or cried, Ada didn't soothe him or indulge in baby talk. Invariably, she barked, "Give that calf more rope!" To a girl raised in South Minneapolis, this was an incomprehensible, not to mention unsympathetic, response. Yet, imagine a bawling calf, snubbed up too short to nail the horseflies worrying his hide or to reach the clover at its feet. Give that calf more rope, and it will be more content and quit its crying. Once when I stayed overnight at her house, Nathan and I slept upstairs. The audible whoosh and swoop of a low-flying bat woke me. I called out fearfully to Ada, "There's a bat up here." In the same voice that she used on Rover, she told me to get on down here. I quickly clumped down the stairs. Nathan clutched my chest. The bat followed. Ada corralled it in her kitchen and quickly hooked a blanket across the doorway, cutting off the bat's escape. With a broom and an impressive economy of effort, Ada knocked the bat down, stepped on its head, scooped it up in the dustpan, and flung the carcass out the back door. Ada was cowed only by the Bible thumpers who stopped on their rounds. A staunch Christian, she enjoyed the company and the discussions. However, I do recall one summer's day when the Christian ambassadors dropped by and she spoke to them through the screen door, leaving them on her doorstep where the women in skirts fidgeted and stamped. When they left, how Ada cackled at their apparent discomfort. While delivering the Lord's good news, mosquitoes were taking indecent advantage of those scriptural prescribed short skirts. Only men in the family, apparently, shall wear the pants. Ultimately, Ada's family moved her to an old folks' home in the Twin Cities. We were surprised to hear that she liked it there. She made new friends and again enjoyed all the visiting. Several years later, after the birth of another son, a divorce, and two moves, I had that second encounter with a bear. As before, the bear, unaware of the stranger who followed behind, plodded forward on the blacktop's shoulder, never stopping to investigate the roadside vegetation, nor deviating from its course. I figured that eventually the bear would hear me and run off, but it didn't, and as I jogged nearer, I saw that what I mistook for a bear was actually Ilma Lekander in a black raincoat out for a stroll. Ilma, another widow, lived ahead, back from the road under some large pines, in a small, funky-looking trailer house perched at the very edge of a creek. With a brief greeting, I breezed by her at a run. I didn't get to know Ilma, although I heard recently that she, too, had an encounter with a bear. She had packed her garbage into her car, intending to take it to the dump. But the dump was closed, so she returned home, thinking to go the next day. She left her bundled trash in the car and cracked the window to disperse any rank odors. A bear caught the scent and, with its claws and powerful paws, caught the edge of one partially rolled down window. The next morning, she found her car window smashed, her garbage strewn, the interior of her car shredded. In my early 30s, and a runner, I thought Ilma, in her black raincoat, by comparison, was probably ancient. I imagined her to be a wild woman whose house, after dark, would raise itself on stout chicken legs, swing around to face the forest, and then settle on its haunches like a mother hen who covers her chicks with the sweep of her outstretched wings. Doors and windows would spring open to let in the creatures of the night. Owls roosted in her rafters, their carnivorous appetites unaroused by the antics of wide-eyed flying squirrels. Wolves sat at her side, heads cocked to invite a thorough scratching behind the ears, that simple luxury for which their tamer canine cousins traded a lifetime of freedom. Such was the imagination of a young woman about the life of a solitary crone. My mother always claimed I was a dramatic child. After some decades, I live in Ilma Lekander's neighborhood again. Now I am the old woman, a septuagenarian, a fancy and nearly impossible to pronounce word meaning I'm 70. It was so much more fun to say, well, it was sexagesimal. Now there's a term to get somebody's attention. I'm sexagesimal. You can say that if you're in your 60s. Sexagesimal. If you speak Latin or are Catholic and remember Sexagesima Sunday in the pre-1970 liturgy, you know that being sexagesimal has nothing to do with sex or sexiness. It refers to the 60th of something, the years between 60 and 69, or the 60th day before Easter Sunday, pre-Lent. Sexagesimal no more. There's nothing very sexy sounding about being septuagenarian. Just one damn long seven-syllable word for having lived a long time. No longer a runner, I walk and often make that spot on the creek where Ilma Lekander lived in her mobile home my out-and-back turnaround. The short, circular dirt driveway is spongy with long years' accumulation of fallen pine and fir needles. The trailer house is gone. A pipe sticks out of the ground where once there was a pump. a mound, the detritus of one woman's sojourn, is overgrown with grasses and weeds. On a hot day, the shade of those tall trees is a brief respite before I turn back to walk home. It occurs to me that someday, when I'm trudging down the blacktop, dressed for the cold, perhaps, in my black mid-thigh down jacket, I might give pause to another pedestrian or a motorist. Peering down that long, lonesome road, they ask, "What's that?" with a catch in their throat, signaling, if not fear, a momentary new alertness, an awareness. Is that a bear? When they pass at great speed, as youth always does, I wonder what they will see. Just an old woman in a black jacket out taking in the day? Or will a new story hatch? This one day, when I was driving the back roads, what I thought was an old woman on the road ahead of me turned out to be a bear walking on its hind legs. But before I could really tell what it was, I mean it could have even been Bigfoot, she dropped to all fours and ran off into the woods. Age, and our perception of aging, so dependent on our present age. One thing is certain. Age is a shape-shifting experience.
When I go down that funeral road, Lord, I'm gonna be dressed up fine. I'm gonna have me a nice new suit and tie like I never could have afforded when I was alive. Well, I ain't dead yet. Let me wear that suit right. Ain't nobody gonna see it when I'm locked in that box underneath the ground. Lord, I ain't dead yet. Give me my flowers now. When I go down that funeral road, there's gonna be a big old band. Gonna play all my favorite songs. Well, they plant me in the sand. Ah, but I ain't dead yet. Let me hear that music now. There ain't no way I can hear it when I'm locked in that box underneath the ground. They're gonna have nice things to say. They're gonna say, you know, he was a good egg. Yeah, even don't really feel that way. Ah, but I ain't dead yet. Tell me what you think right now. You can't look me in the eye when I'm locked in that box underneath the ground. Flowers everywhere. All my friends are gonna send some to show how much they care. And I ain't dead yet. Let me have them flowers now. There ain't no way I'm gonna smell them when I'm locked in that box underneath the ground. Thank you.
I love that Charlie Parr song. Music and words for spirit and courage every week at this time on KAXE KBXE. Our broadcast service is supported by our listeners. Thanks for keeping it going. And this program also receives support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. To judge by popular culture, Americans of the 21st century have a sense that we are living in end times. Whether it's the zombie apocalypse or any of the dystopias that fuel our imaginations, young adult novels and television epics, there's clearly a sense that things as they are won't go on as they are. Something very different and much worse is waiting for us. I think that general anxiety might be one of the sources of the spate of hot new television shows about the afterlife. There have always been plenty of stories about the supernatural, ghosts, angels, and demons influencing the lives of the living, but these new shows are more about the lives of the not living, what happens to us when we die. Generally, these programs imagine the afterlife as a vast bureaucracy, with dozens of functionaries fulfilling official tasks without any idea themselves of the overall design, and the newly dead are variously treated as customers, civilians, or recruits sometimes, given assigned tasks and given no answers to their questions. In Miracle Workers, Steve Buscemi portrays God as a past-his-prime corporate CEO who, like everyone else in a bureaucracy, has only a vague idea of everything that's going on. None of these programs encourage much trust in authority. Part of their popularity, I guess, is their shared message that you've got no one to trust but yourself and the people around you. These shows are mainly about the question of the living. What do we owe to each other? The Netflix series Forever is about this explicitly. A married couple, Fred Arneson and Maya Rudolph, are stuck in their lives in their marriage, and when their lives are over, their marriage is not. They're stuck in a joyless suburb with nothing to do forever. It's a comedy about courage and imagination and what it takes to walk into the unknown. The suburbs and the programmed experience of a Disneyland or other unseen corporate entity is also central to the vision of The Good Place, the comedy hit now in its fourth season, I think, on broadcast television. It's a funny show and goofy, with attractive comic characters, both human and immortal. But still, its popularity is surprising to me, considering that the script often quotes Kant or Hegel, explains things like utilitarianism. This show about the afterlife really is about good and bad, not on some cosmic scale, but in individual choices to gratify our selfish desires or see ourselves in those around us. The show also breaks a fundamental convention of situation comedy in that its characters change. They learn from experience. They can grow just like living people do. Sitcom characters never can do that. My favorite of these shows is the trippiest of them. It's called Russian Doll, also on Netflix, a 6-hour journey into parallel universes. The program's tagline is, "Dying is easy, it's living that's hard." Like the movie Groundhog Day, its main character, played by the fabulously foul-mouthed Natasha Lyonne, is caught in a time loop, dying over and over again, to find herself each time back at the mirror in her friend's apartment where a big birthday party is being thrown in her honor. The afterlife in this show has no corporate bureaucracy, no processes, and no procedures as far as we can tell, because, as Natasha says, life is just a box of timelines. For every self-destructive act, there's an alternative timeline in which a better choice can be made, and ultimately, like Groundhog Day, the show is redemptive. It points us toward the source of joy. Both Russian Doll and The Good Place, one raunchy and dark, the other sunny and silly, are for sure products of life in our digital age. All it takes on these shows is a swipe of the hand to get a reset. Both of these and the other new comedies about death are also, in their different ways, deeply subversive. Subversive of orthodoxy, for sure, and of authority, and of the ruling ideology of our culture, an ideology of acquisition and self-satisfaction. These stories tell us that it is possible to live without fear, fear of life or fear of death, and maybe that can open our eyes a little bit to the examples of the real humans around us who are living that way. You're tuned to Stay Human on Northern Community Radio. Up next, poet Aaron Wanger with his piece, Shared Breath.
Well, it's springtime, you know, and in the spring, a young man's fancy turns to, right? Love. So does an old man's, but in a different way. So this is Shared Breath. Have shared life, shared our very breath, across timelines, her and I. Shared long enough to have seen Shawnee old oak trees fallen, long enough to have seen deeds redshifted into memories. Have walked far enough atop the granite ridges of our Canadian shield, walked long enough to watch generations of ravens over those ridges holding the sky like lovers, and walked long enough to bury generations of good dogs along the way. Have planned and worked together long enough to build log homes and watch incredulously as new wood turned the color of old honey right before our eyes, long enough to watch the sun turn a father. Have held the faith into each other long enough to find more love than we even guessed possible back then, holding on to hope harder than each other in a clover field, under a blue sky, and under the hawk when we were young. And if I could have known back then that ending was certain, was waiting there just outside the fire circle for us, I would still have chosen, still have dared to be with her. And I believe in hummingbirds more than the physics of things. And I believe more in love than loss. And I believe we'll always find each the other. We'll always fly again against the summer sky.
Aaron Wanger's poem Shared Breath pairs well, I think, with this next story. Matthew Miltich was asked by his young grandson, what happens to us when we die? And he wrote this bedtime story.
The Leaf Who Wanted to Be a Bird. Once upon a time, a tiny bud near the very tip-top of a tall white oak tree began to feel a stirring, very tiny and almost imperceptible at first. It came from beneath him where he was attached to his branch and felt like a vibration, as if a sound were beginning under him and trying to find its way into the air around him right through his little bud of a body. This stirring had a taste. It was a tiny bit sweet, as if he was tasting a candy too thin even to see. It felt cool, too, but not cold. He couldn't remember falling asleep, but he must have been asleep because these feelings were like waking up. He fell asleep again. When he woke, he felt the stirring stronger than ever, and it felt good. It was like stretching out your arms when you first wake in the morning, when you feel still only half awake and your muscles are stiff from sleep, but you're glad to be getting up. For a few days, he fell asleep every night when it began to get dark and woke again in the morning with each day's new light, and each time he woke, he felt stronger. He was growing, he began to understand, even when he was asleep, because almost every new day he was a little bigger and stretched out farther, and this felt wonderful, like coming out from under the blankets when you're ready to get out of bed. And then one night, he stayed awake all night, and in the morning he was no longer just a bud. He had opened up and unfurled and become a little leaf. He was green and smooth and had wonderfully scalloped edges. He could tell how handsome he was. He felt the sun shine on him. As it shone, it warmed him. It felt so good he could tell he was actually growing larger little by little, and the first stirring of life he'd felt when he was just a tiny bud now became a steady hum, like some beautiful music coming through him, but it wasn't as if he only heard the music. No, it was as if he himself was the music. When the sun shone during the day, he felt warm and good, and when it grew dark at night, he felt cool and peaceful. And when it rained, he felt wildly happy, because after the rain, he would taste a delicious sweetness all through his leafy body. Day by day, he grew, and as the wind blew, he fluttered. This was his happiest feeling of all. The wind blew him this way and that way, but he was so strong, and his attachment to his branch was so secure. It was as if he was on a wild ride, but so safe he never felt afraid. He lived high above the world, and he felt lucky and proud. All around him, the leaves of his family tree fluttered or garnered sunlight, and all seemed strong and good. One quiet, hot, humid afternoon early in summer, clouds gathered in great creamy billows which built upwards higher and higher, and the sky grew dark, though it was the very height of afternoon, and flashes of lightning forked through the clouds, and the whole sky boomed and rumbled. Suddenly the wind roared across the leaf in all of his family tree and all the trees of his forest. Some leaves were torn from their branches and swept away in the wind. Some branches broke and were hurled away, but the bud, who had become a leaf, though the wind tore at him, was held safe and secure by his branch high in the oak, and when the storm passed, the air became calm and clear once again. The heavy heat and humidity of the afternoon had been swept away, and the leaf and all the leaves of his family tree gleamed in the sunlight. Now they felt fresh and washed and cleansed, and the leaf, who had been terrified of the storm, was suddenly wildly happy. A leaf could survive such a storm and even feel refreshed by it. Storms came now and again, and though they were scary, yes, they were also exciting. The most exciting thing of all to the leaf, though, were the birds that visited or lived in his family tree. Birds came in many forms and many sizes and many colors. They played about in the branches or perched on them, and they fed upon the insects that sometimes crawled upon him or sometimes even took a bite of him, which didn't really hurt, but it was irritating. The birds sang so beautifully that the leaf vibrated with pleasure whenever they sang near him, and their colors were both startling and fantastic. The bluebirds had red breasts and bright blue heads and backs and wings. The indigo bunting was so blue it seemed almost to be electric, like blue lightning. The scarlet tanager, when it flew, was like a swift red arrow, a bright scarlet streak in the sky, and when it perched it was like a flame burning high in his tree. The little warblers came in so many colors and color combinations they seemed to be made of feathered jewels. But most fantastic of all, birds could fly. They might hold as tightly to his branch as he was held, yet they could also spring into the air and fly away. While he was fixed to his own branch of the family tree, the birds were free to fly to any tree they wished, or to visit the ground, or soar into the sky, or dart between the leafy branches. Their flights were so swift, birds in flight disappeared among the other leaves in no time at all, vanished without a trace. Some of the birds built nests in his tree, and in these they laid and incubated their eggs, and soon the eggs hatched into awkward, naked, helpless babies with big soft eyes and large beaks. The adults fed the baby birds, and day by day the little ones grew feathers and became more and more like their parents. The leaf was full grown by the time the baby birds were fledged and ready to fly. The leaf felt conflicted. More than anything, he admired the flights of birds. If they could fly, why couldn't he? If those helpless little blobs, hatched only a few weeks before, were now grown up enough to fly, why couldn't he, a sleek, full-grown green leaf, be able to fly as well? The first flights of the baby birds were awkward, yes, almost more falling than flying, but with only a few practice flights, a few tumbles with flailing wings through the leaves and branches of his tree, they began to achieve controlled flight, and very soon even the most gawky and uncoordinated among them had mastered flight and were free to fly wherever they wished. This left the leaf longing for such freedom for himself, but no, he was firmly attached by his petiole to his branch of the family tree and held fast. He was not unhappy exactly, but he wished whenever he saw a bird take wing that he himself could fly. It would be better, he thought, to be a bird than to be merely a leaf, and so he wished he were a bird. As summer days passed, sunny days and cloudy, rainy days and stormy, humid days and dry, warm days and cool ones, the leaf's desire to be a bird stayed with him. He was not jealous, no. He merely admired the birds in their beauty and freedom and wished he could be one of them so he might know what it was to fly. And then the season began to change. The leaf felt this in the cells of his body, for where he had felt vibrant and moist, now he began to feel sleepy and dry, and the stiffness he'd known at waking now stayed in him through most of the day. His green surface changed and became nut brown. The birds began to feel the change too, as nights grew cooler and longer, and the sun rose in the morning day after day, more and more to the south, and went down behind the trees in the southwestern sky, where just weeks before it had gone down in the northwest. The birds gathered excitedly, talking among themselves, and whole flocks suddenly took flight, as if all the birds together were as one single body, and some of these winged away and did not return. New birds of shapes and colors the leaf had not known began to visit his family tree, and some of these stayed for only a little while, and some of them stayed longer. At every flight of every bird, the leaf wished he could fly too. Then, on a blustery cold afternoon in the autumn, the leaf felt suddenly the strangest sensation of his life. As the wind buffeted him, his stem began to wiggle loose from his branch. He was poised just for a moment high in the tree with only the tiniest membrane of his pedicel holding him to the branch. The gust of wind swept across him, and all at once he was in flight. The leaf had not become a bird exactly, but he flew. A dizzying, twirling, dancing flight he'd taken. The wind boosted him high above his family tree, high above the forest family in which he'd grown and matured. He was ecstatic in a dry, cool sort of way to find himself, after his months of longing, to fly in actual flight. This, of course, did not last very long because, like a kite, and unlike a bird which has wings and muscles, he flew merely because his shape made it possible for the wind to lift and blow him about for a while. But the earth below, with its gravity, pulled at him and he at it, and when the wind subsided for just a moment, he began to slide downward through the thin atmosphere, like a toboggan sliding down a steep hill. He careened through the air toward the ground. At the last second before he would touch down, a gust of wind lifted him once again for a giddy ride in the chilly air, and this happened several more times, and he was glad, but then, as was inevitable, he settled to earth finally in gentle touchdown amid many others of his kind, with many other kinds of leaves. He did not feel sad exactly, but mystified because he did not understand exactly what had happened to him. But he was very tired, so tired he couldn't stay awake a minute longer, and then he slept. The leaf woke every now and then to find many more leaves had fallen all around him, but he felt less and less. Nothing hurt. He was simply tired and wanted to sleep, and at last he fell into a dreamless slumber and knew nothing more. After who knows how long, a faint stirring prodded him awake. He was uncertain how long he'd slept, but it felt like a very long time. He tried to remember his life, but it was so faint in his memory he couldn't really make it out. All he really knew was the familiar stirring from beneath him, a faint sweet taste all through him, and the desire to expand and grow. He was a bud. It was spring. He was about to become a leaf again, but this time his family tree was a maple. This made him happy because the taste spreading through him was wildly delicious. In due time, he unfurled to become a very fine maple leaf, on the twig of a branch halfway up a very tall sugar maple. When the birds began to appear and to perch in his tree and to build their nests, he had a very strange thought. It seemed to him this had happened before, as if he were remembering it. He found that he wished to be like the birds, to be able to fly, and he had the curious feeling he'd been wishing this from before he was even a bud, so that now the faintest memory of his life as an oak leaf came back to him now and then, just a little at a time. In the fall, he took flight once again and fell to the forest floor as before and slept. One year, he was a blade of grass. Another year, he was a purple aster. During each life, he dreamed of being a bird, for every summer he marveled at the beauty and freedom of birds. One spring he awoke weak and soggy and warm and trapped somehow beneath a smooth, round surface. He felt the familiar stirring of life. He did not quite remember how long he'd slept or how he'd come to be in this confined space, and he felt weak and small, but his desire to push outward, to expand, to grow, these strivings were strong in him, and so he pushed against the barrier that kept him inside itself, that enclosed and confined him. And little by little, weak as he was, he hammered against the smooth, curved walls within which he was held, and the hard surface began to give way finally. He slept for a few minutes when he was too tired to push anymore, but finally he pushed out, and suddenly he could breathe. He was free of his enclosure, but too weak to do anything but rest, and he was soggy and damp, but he felt warm, surrounded by soft, downy filaments, and he slept. When he awoke, he was dry and warm, but so weak he could hardly hold up his head. He was hungry, and someone fed him. He gulped his food and opened his mouth for more, and when he was full, he slept again. For several weeks, he ate and slept, but one morning, he felt very awake and very strong. He'd grown. He was in a round nest with three hatchlings, all about his own size. They had feathers, and so he found had he. He flexed his wings. He stretched his neck. He stood on his 2 feet. He was still very small, but he was a bird. He felt as if somehow, in this single moment, he'd become what he'd always wished to be. His siblings and he sat in their nest in the very tip-top of a white oak tree. He knew with certainty, and this made him very happy, that in almost no time at all, he'd be able to fly.
Thanks to Matthew Miltich for that, and to Aaron Brenger, Terry O'Brien, Heidi Holton, and Mike Elliott for being part of our program today. My name is Michael Goldberg. I'm here every week with Stay Human. Hope you can be too.